Hi everybody, I'm Jack L, and I'm an alcoholic. And it's really good to be here. I haven't been to Las Vegas for quite a while, and this really seems like a very enthusiastic group. I certainly enjoyed Betty's talk, especially that part about Bob. I don't know what it is about this guy, Bob. I mean, I met him for the first time today, and I felt like hitting on him. Anyway, I flew over just a few hours ago, and now, actually, there was a little bit of turbulence on the plane, and whenever that happens to me, I've been sober now for almost 22 years, and whenever I'm on a plane and there's any turbulence at all, I always come face to face with what I think is a very profound question. And the question is, I always ask myself if the pilot suddenly announced, "We're going down," am I the kind of an alcoholic who would storm the galley for those miniature Jack Daniels bottles, knowing no one would probably ever know. But I hope I never have to find that out. If you're new tonight, I want to welcome you to Alcoholics Anonymous and say to you that if you're feeling any remorse or anxiety, I'm sure there are a lot of people in here sitting on a lot of pain, it's going to be okay. You stay here, you keep coming back here, you're going to be all right. When I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I felt like I was going to die from how bad I felt. But I stuck around, I did what people suggested that I do, I fought them tooth and nail, and I ultimately felt better, and I've been on this road for a long time. And if I was going to give you one piece of advice on this night, if you're new, it would be don't listen to the voice in your head. I see a lot of blank faces out there. Well, what do I mean by that? What voice am I referring to? The voice that right at this red hot moment is saying, "What voice is that chump talking about?" That voice. Don't listen to that voice, because it'll drive you right out of Alcoholics Anonymous. I've been around for over 21 years, and that voice is certainly prevalent in my life, and I have just learned how to deal with it. It's still there. From time to time, it tells me that a slight toothache is jaw cancer, that a busy signal means she's in bed with my best friend, and that's really my main problem today, is being able to distinguish the difference between reality and that voice. And I'll give you a quick illustration of that voice. Not too long ago, I was out of work, and I decided that I was going to raise my employment stock a little bit by going back to college, which we all hear a lot of people do in AA. And so I had to take some classes, and some of them went all the way back to high school classes. One of them was algebra, high school algebra. And I was going to this community college. One night I went to a party, and there was a woman there that I was very attracted to. I went over and started talking to her. And fortunately, I got her phone number. And as I was driving away from the party, you know, I was feeling really good, as guys have a tendency to do, and they do that. And then I had to study for this algebra test. And it was called a chapter called Rationalizing Radicals. And I was studying all day on Sunday for this test, and I wanted to do well. But I just wasn't getting it. I couldn't understand rationalizing radicals. And my voice started to take me on a classic trip while I was doing this. And the first thing I thought about was, What is going on here? I thought this was high school algebra. I mean, I can't do... Are they trying to tell me that these 18 and 19-year-olds can do this? Now, what are they doing, giving me special lessons as opposed to the other 18 and 19-year-olds in the class? And I can't cut it. And I thought, you know, I can't believe how stupid I am. I mean, I'm stupid. No wonder I'm not working. No wonder I have to take this. And I kept thinking about how stupid I was, and I started to get a little angry, and then I thought, you know what? Why do I even have to take this stupid class in the first place? Oh, yeah, because I need a job. That's why. I need a job. That's why I'm taking this class. I shouldn't be studying rationalizing radicals. I should look through the Sunday classifieds. So I went over and grabbed the classifieds from my desk, and I knew I was going to need a highlighter and a magnifying glass as I was looking things over. And I started looking through endless pages of the LA Times. And I just thought, you know, I don't know how to do any of these jobs. I don't know anything about being a fire sprinkler fitter. What is that? A vocational analyst? I mean, I'm looking for a job. How can I analyze vocations? And I thought, I'm not only stupid, I'm unemployable. That's what's the matter with me. I'm stupid and I'm unemployable. And I started to get into a very dangerous area, and I thought, you know what they taught me in Alcoholics Anonymous? Don't go down this road. When you're going down this negative road, try and think of something positive, you know. And then I suddenly remembered I had that phone number. And I pulled out that phone number, and I got the phone ready, and I sat there, and I looked at that number, and I thought, oh, what's the point? I'm stupid. I'm unemployable. I'm unemployed. I mean, why would this woman go out with me? Why even call her? I'm stupid, I'm unemployable, and I'm unemployed. She's not going to want to go out with me. I don't have any money. She'll never want to go out with me. That gold-digging bitch. And as soon as I got to that point, I remembered something that I have learned here in Alcoholics Anonymous. I learned the answer to my problem at that moment. The answer was, go back to the top of the chapter. Go back to the top of the chapter and start again. Get off this road, this self-destructive road that I have a tendency to get on, and go back and start at the beginning of the chapter again. And as we say in Alcoholics Anonymous, take the action. And so I started studying it again. And, you know, I know when you tell a story like that, obviously it's a more satisfying one if there's an uplifting ending. So, you know, I'll just tell you for that reason, I did take the test, and I got an A on the test. Now, you might be curious as to whether or not I ever called the woman. No, I didn't. Why should I with that money-grubbing attitude that she had? You know, I was talking to somebody recently who related an experience that they had. They're in AA. And if you've been around AA for any amount of time, I'm sure this happens here in Vegas too. The guy had been going to a lot of meetings, and he had occasion to attend a civilian birthday party. Now, if you don't know what that is, it just means that it was not an alcoholic birthday party. They had liquor there, and they were serving liquor, and he'd gone to this civilian birthday party. And when the time came to sing happy birthday, as I said, he'd probably been to a few meetings too many. And at the end of the song, he sang that familiar three-word solo. keep coming back. And and when he told me that, it reminded me of a kind of a similar situation that I had had when I was on a job interview. And I was sitting across from a lady. It was actually a job I wanted, which I know is probably a novelty. But I was sitting across from the personnel director, and we had discussed the usual background and so on. And then she said, "You know, I have almost a sixth sense about people. I can tell things about people, and I'm very good at it. And sometimes I make mistakes, and I actually made a mistake recently. I hired a guy, and he was supposed to come to work at 8 o'clock in the morning, and he didn't come to work at 8 o'clock in the morning. He showed up at 11 o'clock in the morning, and these are her words, not mine. He showed up skunk drunk. And maybe I had been to a few meetings too many that week, because when she said that he had showed up at 11 a.m. skunk drunk, my spontaneous reaction was, "Oh, no, sorry, that's terrible. Oh, that's disgusting, that's awful. What, it's 11 o'clock in the morning drunk?" And yet, that is why I'm here tonight, because I do know what it is to be drunk at 11 o'clock in the morning and pretty much any other hour that you can name, because I use alcohol. I use alcohol for the effect that it gives me. It allows me to escape. It makes me taller. It makes me tougher. It makes me more appealing in my mind, and it makes me more competent. It makes me feel adequate when I don't feel adequate. And so, of course, I use it on a regular basis because I want to feel okay. Yeah, I just want to feel okay. So I know what it is to drink. But maybe most important, I know what it is to drink because I feel self-contempt because I'm drinking. And so I have to drink to forget the contempt I feel over my drinking. So in a sense, I know what it is to drink because I drink. Because I can't stand that I drink. And we tell newcomers, we tell anybody who's having a problem and is thinking about going out and having a drink, "Hey, don't do that. Don't go out and have a drink. It's not going to make anything better. It's not going to make anything better." Well, you know what? I think we all know that. It doesn't take an intellectual giant to know that if life isn't working and I go out and take a drink, it's not going to make things better. But you see, the kind of personality that I have, that idea is irrelevant. Because I have the kind of a personality that if I were to take a drink, God forbid, it would not be because I thought it was going to make my life better. It's because I'm the kind of guy who, when my life is not going the way that I want it to go, then screw it all. I will drink to destroy what's left of it. Not to feel better, to feel worse. Because that's what I am. That's how it works for me. I remember when I was a kid, I don't know, 7, 8 years old, lived in a rural area, lived on a farm, and my best friend lived down the street, about my age, and he was fortunate enough to have all the great toys. I didn't. I went over. We were good friends. He let me play with his toys, and all summer long, I actually had our two favorite toys. He had a, this is back in the 50s, he had about a 9-inch tall rubber monkey, and a 9-inch tall red rubber devil. And he would use the monkey and I would use the devil, and we'd have what, you know, we'd do what kids do. We'd have the adventures of the monkey and the devil all day long. And then at the end of the day, I would return the devil to him and I'd go home. And one weekend he said to me, "Jack, how would you like to take the devil home for the weekend?" And I was thrilled. it's my favorite toy in the whole world. And took the devil home, took the devil to bed that night, got up the next day, went outside the farmhouse, sat on the front stoop, beautiful day, shining sun, birds chirping, breeze blowing, and I'm sitting there on the stoop and I've got the red devil with me. And as I said, it's back in the 50s, and the craftsmanship of these toys is expert. I mean, the features on this guy and on that monkey were perfect. And so I'm sitting there, and I'm feeling as good as I ever have in my life. I'm just looking at this rubber devil, my favorite toy. And as I keep looking at it, I notice just the tiniest flaw. There's a little hangnail of rubber on its ear. And when I see that, I get very upset. And I want to fix it. So I take my two fingernails and attach it to that tiny little hangnail of rubber and I pluck it. I feel a little better, and I look at it, and I notice that I have plucked a little too much. So naturally, because I'm upset, I decide to even up the ears. I go over to the other ear, and I take a little pluck out of that, and it's a little too much. So I go back to the other ear. And I go back and forth and back and forth. And then suddenly when I'm looking at the devil, a surge of horror races through my entire body. Because as I look at this, my absolute favorite toy, and it doesn't even belong to me, I now notice it has no ears at all. And it is at that moment that I do something that I probably have repeated many, many times in my life. Because I was very upset, because my emotions were surging, because I was so upset. So I did what made sense at that moment. I ripped his head off. Now, if you're wondering what that has to do, well, let me just tell you about some of my romantic relationships. Now, I remember back when I was married and my wife, who was not an alcoholic, and I were sharing a very romantic evening on a special occasion. There was a bottle of wine there, and then she had maybe a half a glass. I killed the rest, of course. And it was the kind of night where we were just so in touch with each other and emotionally intimate. And we told each other that we loved each other, but not in the way that a lot of people do, you know, pass the spinach, I love you, or pick up the cleaning, and I, by the way, I love you. This was meaningful. And so we were at our absolute peak. There we were sitting on the couch. And I remember feeling pretty much like I did when I was out on the front stoop with the red devil that morning. I felt that good. I felt that good. And then I started looking at my wife. And I said, you love me, don't you? And she said, well, yes, Jack. I mean, I think that's pretty obvious tonight, you know. And I said, yeah. but tell me something. I was just a hypothetical question. Suppose I were blind. Would you still love me then? And she just kind of stared at me. What? What are you talking about? No. I'm just a hypothetical question. I'm curious. Suppose I were blind and crippled. Would you still love me? Jack, I don't know what you're doing. Are you doing one of your things? No. I'm just asking a hypothetical question. I'm curious. Look, I've been in a car wreck. I'm blind. I'm crippled. And I have a speech impediment. Would you still love me? Look, Jack, I'm really getting upset. This is crazy. This is neurotic. What are you talking about? I'm just asking a question. I'm curious. I'm trying to ascertain some information here. Help me out. Well, look, Jack, if you were all those things, I mean, God, I don't know. I mean, obviously you wouldn't be you, so I guess I wouldn't love you. And I said, you bitch. I knew I couldn't trust you. You know, the relationship area around here is, you know, I don't know if it's my 21 years, but I'm getting a vibe that there is a relationship problem in this room. And I'm not sure if it's come. Anyway, if you're new, I already told you not to listen to the voice. Obviously, don't drink here in between meetings, but I've already told you about the voice. The next thing I would tell you, and we tell people this in Alcoholics Anonymous all over Southern California, I'm sure it's said around here too, we try to encourage you, if you're new, and you've probably heard this, not to get involved in a relationship, a romantic kind of a relationship, your first year around here. Now, it sounds like a very noble idea, for sure. I've never sponsored anyone who adhered to it, but but it is nonetheless a noble idea. Well, one thing that's so silly about it is, you know, it's almost like we're saying, look, don't get involved your first year, but on day 366, you're now ready. If you've ever sponsored anybody, I think you understand what I'm talking about. In fact, anybody I've ever sponsored, I got to tell you, let me put it this way. I've never sponsored anybody in Alcoholics Anonymous who called me up, who was fairly new, and said, Jack, I was at a meeting last night, and I am telling you, man, I met a woman. This is, the sparks were flying. I was just absolutely, the chemistry was there, and I want to move on it. I want to go with it. What do you think? And if I said to that person, well, you know, around here in Alcoholics Anonymous, we don't think it's a good idea to get involved with anyone in your first year romantically, I have never had someone I sponsor say, that's a good idea. The only people in Alcoholics Anonymous that I know who did not get romantically involved their first year on the program were the ones who had no opportunity. In fact, I've often thought, you know, if we're going to tell newcomers something more realistic about involvement, about a time limit, why not say, look, around here we think it's a very good idea that you don't get romantically involved for ever. And yet I was new once, and when I came here and I suddenly realized I wasn't going to be able to drink to make myself feel better, it made sense to me to get involved in a relationship, and the stimulus was there. She was new, and I have to tell you, even today, I look back on it, it was beautiful. An incredibly beautiful, touching relationship. We were absolute soulmates. I had never, ever experienced anything like that. It was just so beautiful. For about 16 days. Red hot for 16 days. And then I spent the next year and a half trying to revive and take us back to where we were for those 16 days. And if you're a guy like me, it's not a good idea to try and do that. It's a lot of time down the drain. It's an odd thing. When a pet dies in my life, or a relative dies, I have no problem attending to their burial. But you know, if I have a dead relationship in my life, I will allow the corpse of that relationship to linger in my home until it stinks up the place. Until it decomposes. And the thing is if you're a guy like me and you're tenacious romantically, even once it has decomposed, I am still not defeated. Because I can still roll around in the scent of it like a dog. After it's long over. And I'll tell you how I did that. It's a miracle that I didn't get drunk, I must say. It was the help of a lot of people who had been there before. And I'll tell you how you roll around in the scent of a relationship. You have what I would call the home entertainment center available to you. I'm not talking CD, DVD, or TV. I'm talking about waiting until it's a rainy Sunday afternoon, going to the closet and taking down my shoebox of memorabilia. My souvenirs from the relationship that I remember putting on our song because it goes with the rainy day. And actually, we had a dandy. This was back in about 1981. It was a song by a group called Foreigner called I've Been Waiting for a Girl Like You to Come Into My Life. So I thought it was a great choice for her. So actually, it wasn't the perfect choice for it. Had it been perfect, it would have been, I've been waiting for a girl like you to come into my life and treat me like scum. That would have made it perfect. So I sat there, and I started exploring the contents of the box. I remember my friends used to refer to me as an archaeologist of love. It was Sunday, it was raining, and I would go on a dig. And just, you know, open the box, I remember there were a couple of concert stubs from Bob Seger, and just kind of study the jagged edges of those for about a half hour for some pain. That works up that exquisite pain for you. And then I remember I had a snapshot in there of Happier Days, the two of us. It was me looking out at the camera, big smile on my face, and then, of course, she was looking up at me adoringly. The only thing about that picture is that it had scotch tape going in all different directions on it, because depending on my mood, I would either tear it up or put it back together again on a weekly basis. And I was very fortunate to have something organic in the box, which was she was absent-minded enough to have left one of her hairbrushes behind. And I remember I would take that hairbrush, and I was lucky enough that there was some hair on it. And I would take that hairbrush, and to the sound of Foreigner, I would peel off a hair, just kind of hold it up to the light, drop it, and then just watch it float zigzag down to the floor. And I remember one of the saddest days I ever had was when I ran out of hairs. I am the kind of guy that really shouldn't be, you know, when we talk about rigorous honesty around here, applying it in all facets of our life, and I must say, to amuse myself from time to time, I've often considered what it would be like to be rigorously honest when I saw someone that I was attracted to, and to just approach them in a rigorously honest way. So might be in an AA meeting, maybe go up to her and just say, yeah, hi, I really want to be rigorously honest, because that's what we do around here. And so in that spirit, I just want you to know that I have never seen you before, but I fell head over heels in love with you about 8 seconds ago. And I thought I would just tell you a little bit about myself, see if there's any chemistry there. Maybe we could move on from there. So what do you say if I talk about our relationship a little bit, and let me just say a few things that are pertinent that you should know about me from the standpoint of rigorous honesty. I have the emotions of a 12-year-old. I spent about 14 years consuming, and I figured this out once, about 4,400 six-packs. I'd say in the neighborhood of 4,000 bottles of wine, a half a ton of vodka, and an enormous, you know, women always want to know what we're going to do this weekend kind of thing. And let me tell you, I'm a guy who really loves sitting in a dim room just listening to the hum of the refrigerator. As a matter of fact, a romantic relationship to me is what I would call an isolation duet. And then finally, I know you're probably, because, you know, it's traditional, you probably wonder what my ambition is. You know, what degree of ambition do I have? That's important. I mean, you're probably interested in knowing my nest-building qualifications. Basically, how am I doing in the old twig-gathering department? I want you to know I'm very ambitious. I've always aspired for the same job, to get somebody to pay me to house-sit my own place. See, when the people that I sponsor call me, they're not calling about fighting a drink, what we call fighting a drink. See, I haven't fought a drink. I haven't craved a drink. I'm one of those lucky people. I haven't craved a drink for over 21 years. Not emotionally. You know, I've intellectually toyed with the idea from time to time, maybe standing. I might have pictured what it was like standing on a Monterey pier, with the dew in the air, and maybe have on a navy pea coat with the collar up, a Marlboro hanging out of my mouth, and one of those luggage shop flasks. I just take a hit off of it, filled with Remy Martin, just kind of get the dew off me. I've thought about things like that. Entertain myself at stoplights. But I have not crave the drink, and I'm very lucky because there are those who do. I happen to sponsor a lot of people that are not newcomers. And when they call me, they are not calling about fighting a drink. They are calling because they feel anxious and frustrated and full of fear and full of anger, and they want me to somehow be of some kind of service to them. And of course, I'm not qualified really to do that. I remember a guy called me up one time and told me how depressed he was. And I started asking him a lot of questions. I was just bluffing. I didn't know what to tell him. And I happened to, by accident, hit on the right question. I said, "Where are you?" It was like a weekday afternoon, about 2 o'clock. He said, "I'm at home." I said, "Well, aren't you supposed to be at work?" He said, "Yeah, well, I didn't feel like going." And I said, "Well, let me ask you something. Where are you specifically?" He said, "Well, I'm sitting in a chair in the living room." And I said, "Are the shades drawn?" And he said, "Yeah, but what does that have to do with anything?" I said, "Here's what I want you to do. I'm your sponsor. I'm going to give you some direction. Now, you live about a block from a mall. I want you to stand up. Okay? Now, you stood up. When we get off the phone, I want you to go out, walk the block and a half to the mall at 2 o'clock in the afternoon, go into the mall, go to 3 different shops in that mall, and ask a clerk in there some question. You don't have to buy anything, just ask them a question about the merchandise, and then call them." And, you know, the guy had a lot of resistance. He went, and he did this. He called me. I said, "How do you feel?" He said, "Well, I feel better." Why? Because he stood up. Because he walked out into the sun. Because there is magic in sunlight. There is magic in movement. And that's why we try to tell you to take an action. I have to take all that energy that I have a tendency to turn on myself and put it out somewhere else. And I always feel better. If you're new, I would suggest you think of AA as a softball game in which I encourage you to play the active positions. Play pitcher or catcher or first base or shortstop. Don't be playing right field here. Because you're just going to churn up a lot of resentment. Now, when these guys call me, I really have only one. There's really only one thing to tell them. And I actually read about this 15 years ago. It's about a guru somewhere in the Himalayas who was approached by a bunch of esteemed journalists who said to him, "You know, what's the secret to peace, inner peace? How do I get to where I'm okay, you know? Can you tell us in 25 words or less?" And the guy said, "Well, I can tell you in 2 words. Drop it." And we say that in AA. We call it turning it over. Drop it. Give up. Let go. Say uncle. When you are in the throes of your emotion, say uncle. When I was in grammar school, I remember somebody getting me in a headlock and saying, "Jack, you say uncle, and I will release you." But I would not say uncle. I'm not that kind of guy. I wouldn't say uncle. Because I wanted to look good while in a headlock. And then after many headlocks over the years in grammar school and junior high, one day, for reasons I can't explain, somebody said, "Say uncle and I will release you." And I said uncle. And I made an extraordinary discovery. I no longer felt that crushing sensation on my head. Now, for me to stand up here and tell you about turning it over when you're in the throes of your emotion, come on. When people tell you they turned it over in the throes of their emotion, that is the same thing as when people tell you that they have no judgment when they're an alcoholic. Now, as you've probably heard people say, well, I don't judge anymore. Let me set you straight on that one. When this meeting is over, there will be traditionally a number of little groups that go off and have what we call coffee. But having coffee after a meeting is a code term for Judge Fest. If you don't believe me, if you go to coffee tonight, just look around you and listen. Turning it over in the throes of emotion, dropping it, letting go, is about as easy as detaching my tongue from a frozen pipe. It's real easy to talk about. It's not too easy to do. And when I'm in a situation like that, I do the next best thing. I kneel down and I pray to what I call a higher power that doesn't matter whether I really believe in it or not, because when I'm down, kneeling down, that puts me in a humble position. It takes out the arrogance. And I say, please allow me to want to let this go. And if I can't do that, please allow me to want to let this go. And I just go from level to level to level until I achieve the first, the very bottom level, and then work my way up. Because since I haven't had a drink in 21 years, we don't promise you happiness when you come to Alcoholics Anonymous. Stop drinking tonight. Doesn't necessarily mean you're going to be happy. But I'll tell you what I can guarantee you. You're eligible to be happy. See, when I got here, I was suddenly eligible to be happy. And I hadn't been before. Why? It was very simple. I was always drunk. If I wasn't drunk, then I was justifying my drinking. I certainly wasn't doing what happiness entails. And I don't even know that I'm the kind of a guy who can do happiness well. I mean, I've often said I'd do anything to acquire happiness, short of giving up morbid reflection. So I have to be very careful. I'm very careful with my sobriety. I don't take credit for it. It absolutely proves to me, because I tried to stop many times, and I did stop many times, but I couldn't stay stopped. And I'm one of those guys who just knows. I mean, when I got here and I haven't had a drink, I know there's something bigger than me out there working for me. And so I don't take credit for my sobriety. I just do the things that I was always told. I continue to do them. I continue to take commitments in Alcoholics Anonymous. And if you don't know what a commitment is, let's be honest, it's a dreary task that I do on a regular basis as if it's not dreary. I try to do it with a smile. And I've done those things and I continue to do them because I'm a superstitious guy. I'm a superstitious guy. And what I have to be careful about today in alcohol. I like to say that my image of my sober life today is it takes place in a sobriety bubble. I live in a sobriety bubble. And it's a very flimsy bubble. So I have to treat it with delicacy. And the key to it is that in this bubble, I have roommates, and those roommates are my demons. I have demons, and they share my bubble with me. Now, alcohol is not in the bubble. See, alcohol is outside of the bubble. And depending on how well I maintain the harmony with my demons, I'm okay. But as soon as it gets to me too much, I might just throw my arms up, break the bubble, and I'm suddenly nose to nose with my problem. And these demons, I'll just tell you a little bit about them. One of them is misperception. I seem to misperceive things. I remember I was drunk one long weekend and I had a gallon of wine left. It was getting to be almost 2 o'clock and I started to panic in case I needed that backup. And I went over to this place called Mayfair Market. I hadn't, you know, I don't think I'd showered for a couple of days, certainly hadn't shaved, looked pretty grungy. Went over to this place at 1 o'clock in the morning or 1:30, and I got a great big bottle of Red Mountain wine. Now we all know that checkers in grocery stores just traditionally give you a nice big smile, hopefully when you come up to their check stand. And so I got my big jug of wine, I went up to the check stand, and forgot temporarily that checkers do this traditionally. And so when the checker smiled at me, so I stood there with my jug, I knew why. She wanted me. No doubt in my mind. Now, I wanted to be careful about how I made my move. I've always admired guys who can stand in a check stand and have people around them and they still hit on the checker. I had to be more clever than that, and what I did was I made a mental note of her name tag, and I rushed home and I called the market. Guy answered the phone and I said, yeah, could I talk to Kathy? He said, well, Kathy is, she's working right now. Sorry, you know, she can't come to the phone. I said, no, you don't understand. This is urgent. This is bordering on emergency. And the guy said, all right, hold on. I waited. She came to the phone. Hello? Kathy, yeah. This is Jack. Right away, she was suspicious, didn't know what I was talking about. I wanted to help her identify who I was. So I said, I'm the guy you smiled in the check stand about 15, 20 minutes ago. That didn't help. Further identification. I'm the guy that you smiled at, and I was holding that big jug of Red Mountain wine. Remember me now? And then that's when she hung up on me. But my misperception was, as soon as she hung up, I remember thinking, there's one thing I hate about a woman, it's when she's a tease. Misperception is one of my demons. That's why I have a sponsor, because the way it looks to me, especially when there's emotion involved, and lust is an emotion, I don't see it right. I got to run it past somebody, so I strongly recommend if you don't have a sponsor that you get one. Somebody that you can feel comfortable with, somebody you feel safe with, somebody that you feel like you can tell the truth to. And here's the key, no matter how ugly the truth is. See, I got to tell my sponsor the ugliest stuff going on in here. Otherwise, it eats away at me. Another one of my roommates is obsession. I remember I was sitting at home one Saturday afternoon. I had a couple of hours to kill. Beautiful day. Can do anything I want. Other people are out there boating, going to the movies, going to the beach. You know what I chose to do? I sat in my reclining chair with the shades drawn and considered the prospects of my life for a couple of hours. And during that time, Barbara Streisand came on the radio. She was singing The Way We Were. And you know, there's a lyric in that song, memories are beautiful. And yet, what's too painful to remember, we simply choose to forget. What's too painful to remember, we simply choose to forget. Now, maybe that's what Barbara Streisand does. But what I do Because if it's too painful to remember, I replay it over and over and over and over. That's obsession. I'll just tell you about one more demon in there. We call that projection. You know that one. They all end in I-O-N. I don't know why. Projection. Now, I have been giving an illustration in Alcoholics Anonymous of what projection is for the last 20 years. And it seems to clarify it. It has to do with about 20 years ago, I was talking to a platonic friend, a woman. We hadn't talked for quite a while, and we were catching up. And during the course of our conversation, she told me that she had a guest. A female, a woman from South America, was visiting her from the weekend. This woman was from the country of Paraguay. And there we were, talking some more about some other things. And eventually my friend said, Jack, haven't seen you for a long time. Why don't you drop by? We'd love to see you in person. So I went over to see her. Now, she's a normal type woman. She has this lady staying with her for the weekend, this lady from Paraguay. She's there. Obviously, my friend introduces me to the lady from Paraguay, because that's proper. And I remember when she introduced me to the woman from Paraguay, I put out my hand, and I thought, I don't want to live in Paraguay. Now that is projection, and it is something that I am capable of anytime, any place. Doesn't stop. I had it when I drank, I had it before I drank, I had it in my sobriety. People have asked me, when does it stop? My experience is it doesn't stop. How I respond to it has altered. This up here. Now I remember one time I have projected in my sleep. When I was drinking and I was married, I remember I had a dream one night that my wife was making it with somebody else. And I remember when I got up, I had an attitude. And I just kind of swaggered into the room where she was with that look on my face. And if you're in a relationship, you probably know the kind of look I'm talking about. It's actually a look that I reserve for special occasions in order to tell my partner that I am displeased with her behavior. And I had that look on my face, and she played right into it. She looked at me and said, Jack, what's wrong? And I said, yeah, right. Then I proceeded to describe my dream to her. I told her the whole dream. And she's a normal type woman. Consequently, she had a normal reaction. Her jaw just started to drop slowly as I was describing this whole thing in an accusatory tone. And when I was finished, she said what any normal person would say under the circumstances, Jack, don't you understand? That was just a dream. She thought she had me. I said, yeah, I know it was just a dream. Now, why don't you tell me why I dreamt it? You know, I don't like to call her my ex-wife, that lady that I just spoke of. I like to call her the woman I was once lucky enough to be married to. And I came in here on a divorce. If you're out there and you're feeling the pain of a divorce, I can tell you that's how I got here. And all I can promise you is that if you stick around here, it'll become a faint memory. All of that pain will become a faint memory. I know it's difficult to think that now, but you have to proceed as if that is true. And she's married to somebody else, and we have been the best of friends for 20 years. I stopped drinking the day she told me she was going to divorce me. And she called me recently, which she does from time to time. And the reason she called me, and she was chuckling. And I said, what's so funny? And she said, I just saw a video movie called As Good As It Gets, Jack Nicholson movie. The reason I'm laughing is because that character reminds me so much of you, Jack. It's just unbelievable. And she wasn't putting me down. I didn't feel put down at all. One of the reasons was that when the movie actually came out, I got calls from out of state on it, saying the same thing. I actually felt good that she told me that, and I'll tell you why. Because back in about 1980, when I was married to her, and she had a kid, a little boy that was about 5 years old at the time, and he went to the movies with his dad on a weekend. And when he came back, and she, my wife told me this later, when he came back, she said, how'd you like the movie? And he said, wow, the guy in it really reminded me of Jack. Our Jack. And it happened to be, by coincidence, a Jack Nicholson movie. The Shining. So if I were to tell you my whole trajectory in Alcoholics Anonymous in just one sentence, it would be that when I got here, I was the character called Jack Torrance in The Shining, and with the help of a lot of people, I have become Melvin Udall from As Good As It Gets. Now, speaking of... I don't know why I'm talking about movies, but there was a movie out recently called Life is a House, or As a House, I can't remember which. And I got to thinking about that title. If my life was a house, okay, my present life was a house, here's what I'd say about it. Needs a paint job, needs landscaping, needs electrical work, plumbing work, better car in the driveway. Got all those problems. I'll tell you the one problem my house doesn't have. I don't have a termite problem. There's no inner decay going on these days, for the most part. I am not sitting on a lie. I am not cheating anyone. I am checking in with my sponsor and keeping the termites out because they work very slowly on a house and then one day it crumbles. When I came to Alcoholics Anonymous 21 years ago, I didn't sit down with the president of AA and say, well, look, if I stop drinking and I behave well and I keep my word and I help others, well, what am I going to get in return? Am I going to get more money? Am I going to get the relationship I've always wanted, the job I've always wanted? And I have found out that it wasn't any of that. You know what I get? If I don't drink, I behave well, I keep my word, and I help others, here's what I get. I don't drink. I behave well, I keep my word, and I get to help others. That's what Alcoholics Anonymous has given me, and it keeps the termites out as long as I keep doing those things. If you're new, I really, really encourage you to keep coming back. If you think of AA as a cliff, think of it as the AA cliff. And here we are, standing on the edge of it with you and saying, you gotta jump. You gotta jump. And I'm here to tell you that if you do that, if you're new and you jump, you will go up, not down. Thanks for having me.